Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our political panel, political public servants, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight featuring commentary by conservative Dan Proft, liberal Georgia Logothetis, and talk show host Jim Bohannon. Our program tonight coming to you from our home base on State Street, that great street in Chicago, where our toll-free lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. We're going to talk about a variety of things tonight. We're going to be talking about the ongoing problems in Pakistan, one of the trouble spots of the world, and what it means for the United States and the war on terror. And again, we talked a lot about it last week, but things appear to be getting worse. They're not better. We'll talk about that. But we also want to talk about the big Democratic presidential debate that took place this past week. It was really, the first time that the kid gloves came off and they went after Hillary Clinton, trying to cut her down to size because her finance, her ability to raise money and her standing in the polls continues to grow in most key areas. And there's not much time left to get at her and tear her down. And we're going to talk about whether that really took place or not. And I want to begin by asking our guests, one of the things that Barack Obama said, quote, when people were saying that maybe there was too much ganging up on Hillary Clinton, and specifically was talked about why the Republicans always seemed to be talking about her in their debates, this is what Barack Obama had to say. Quote, "Part of the reason that Republicans, I think, are obsessed with you, Hillary, is because that's a fight they're very comfortable having. It is the fight that we've been through since the 1990s, end of quote. Dan Proft is our card-carrying conservative tonight. Is that why the Republicans go after Hillary? Are they going after her because in their heart they believe she is the easiest to beat?
Yeah, I think it's a combination of two things. I think one is they think that she could be the easiest to beat because she starts with such high negatives. But the other reason, the real practical reason, is that she's going to be the nominee of the other party. So we might as well get to it right now and start dredging up all the stuff from the 90s that provided the basis by which most Americans formulated their opinion of Hillary Clinton, generally not a very favorable opinion, and make sure that she can't reinvent herself in this relatively short year and a half campaign relative to her previous 15 years in the public spotlight. So I think it's a combination of factors, but it's certainly a rush to define Hillary, believing that she will be the nominee.
Our liberal tonight is Georgia Logothetis. She writes for Georgia. She writes as Georgia 10 in the Daily Kos. She's one of the leading liberal bloggers in the United States, based in Chicago. Georgia, always nice to have you with us. What's your reaction to what Barack Obama had to say?
Well, I think that Republican candidates keep talking about Hillary Clinton because it's a way to prove themselves to their base. The Republican base is very disillusioned right now, and there's some key dog whistle politic type of words that they keep throwing out to rile up the base. And the word Clinton is one of those. Every time they send out a fundraising email with the word Clinton in it, they'll get some money back. Every time they mention Hillary Clinton in a debate, it harkens back to all that venom from the 1990s. Basically, Republicans are trying to run on two things: Clinton, being anti-Clinton, and 9/11. Those are the two keywords that show up the most at the debate. And I think that's truly a testament to the fact that they have to rely on those two types of ideas as opposed to real policy ideas.
Jim Bohannon, veteran talk show host for the Westwood One Radio Network, who was in town as the announcer last night on the Radio Hall of Fame broadcast, which was carried by many of these stations all over the country. Jim, always nice to have you with us.
Good to be here. Your
annual visit to see us, great to have you. Insofar as the ganging up and the way the Republicans are going after Hillary and the issue that was brought up in the debate, obviously Democrats are now saying publicly that they think that she's unelectable. Is this Is this the one and only way to get her now?
I think it is, because she does have the organization. She does have the poll numbers. I mean, at this juncture, she pretty much has to stumble unless somebody can throw the long bomb on 4th and 20, to use a football analogy. There has to be some lucky stroke, I think, for somebody else to break through, and I don't see that happening right now. It's going to be Hillary unless she makes a serious mistake. So why not give it a shot? Although it's interesting, of course, to note Bill Richardson, who has already decided he's running for vice president, and quickly dove in to say, wait, let's talk about Republicans. Let's put them down, because I'd like to be the running mate.
Was the aura of inevitability for Hillary Clinton, was it shattered in any way Tuesday night?
No, I don't think so. No. I don't think so at all. And part of it is because the erstwhile contenders to Clinton in the Democratic primary, Obama and to a lesser extent Edwards, if he could win Iowa, they don't really have kind of a raison d'etre for their campaign. I mean, Obama in particular has had the best opportunity to be the contrast candidate that David Geffen and everybody else who doesn't think that Hillary is electable wanted to have. And he has never gotten past his personal story, which is compelling, to a second story about a consistent, articulable vision for where he would take America. And that's why he is languishing, and that's why Hillary continues to extend her lead both in fundraising and at the polls.
You agree with that, Georgia?
Well, I think what we saw in terms of the inevitability is that the tone in the media changed. And I think you saw that in the coverage after the debate, where there was a shift from, you know, discussing Hillary Clinton as the front runner and the inevitable nominee to, well, wait a second, Edwards and Obama are starting to throw punches. And is there something there that deserves to be explored in the media? And so I think that what's going to happen in the next few weeks is obviously Obama's going to be stepping up his attacks. And I think that's going to foster a discussion and an examination of Hillary Clinton's policies. And I think that's something that's been lacking in the coverage so far. And that's why we have this inevitability argument so far.
Do you agree with Dan, however, that Obama has failed to come back with chapter two of his reason, of his raison d'etre? And is it because he doesn't know how to do it, or is he pacing himself and he's going to spring it at the right time?
Well, I can tell you that in terms of the base, what they feel about Obama is that he kind of stuck his toe in the water but is afraid to dive in. And so that's kind of the chapter two that the liberal base has been waiting for in terms of, okay, you set yourself up as a candidate for change, you talk about change, start acting like change. And I think that that's something that we've been kind of just waiting for and holding our breath for. In terms of overall message, I think actually it's Hillary Clinton that's been lacking an overarching theme for her campaign. Edwards obviously brings to the table, you know, a tale of two Americas. So Obama brought to the table the idea of, you know, a different type of politics in Washington. With both of them, you can tell why they're running for president. Hillary Clinton, she came in, I'm in it to win it. So that's kind of been the theme of her campaign, that she's there to win the presidency. Well, yes, but for what? And I think that's why the base isn't really sold on her quite yet.
But in it to win it means that she believes that she is the most electable. And that's where there seems to be some doubt between other Democrats and certainly some in the media as well. I want to talk about that when we come back. 1-800-723-8289 from coast to coast and border to border, taking America's political pulse live from Chicago each and every Sunday night. Back with your calls when we roll on from the Windy City.
Hey, what are you doing this weekend?
I've got a formal black tie dinner downtown.
Wow.
I've got 50-yard line tickets to the big game.
Big.
Then I got put on the VIP list at the Boogie Down nightclub.
Well, listen, I gotta get going.
And I'll be watching the just-released limited edition DVD.
Great.
Of Susie Snowflake.
Susie Snowflake? How did you get that? No way! That Susie is the bomb!
Here comes Susie Snowflake. This year, give the classic holiday trilogy, Hard Rock Coco and Joe, Susie Snowflake, and Frosty the Snowman, digitally remastered to sound better today than they did 45 years ago. Get it online at museum.tv, the Museum of Broadcast Communications online store. Choose from over 5,000 CDs and DVDs. All proceeds benefit the museum and its mission.
And I fail to mention that I've got a little appointment with those Christmas cats, Hard Rock Coco and Joe.
I'm Hard Rock.
I'm Coco.
I'm Joe.
Hard Rock Coco and Joe.
One-click shopping for all your DVD desires. Museum.tv.
From Boston, Massachusetts to Seattle, Washington, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. 1-800-723-8029. We're talking about the Democratic debate this past Tuesday night. And one thing I wanted to ask Jim Bohannon from Westwood One, who joins us tonight. Jim, once upon a time, debates really meant something because there would be debates over debate, who was going to show up. Have we got to a point where there have been so many debates in the primary season that they will lose their impact when it comes down to, just two for the general election, in your view?
There would be that problem if, in fact, people were paying attention. But don't forget, most people are not paying attention right now. I mean, at one time, the presidential debates were a big deal. They took place among the nominees of the major party. There were two or three at most, and it was a really big deal, starting with John Kennedy and Richard Nixon. And it's become now mandatory that the candidates dare not take part, as Lyndon Johnson chose not to do so. If people were paying attention, they would be bored stiff, but let's face it, the vast majority of the public right now has not watched a single debate. Maybe the YouTube debate was the most viewed one, and I doubt that it got a very substantial percentage of the audience.
Do you agree with that, Dan?
Yeah, I think these debates are part of the campaign, but it's inside the bubble. It's an inside the bubble part of the campaign. It's for the Gang of 500 that drives media coverage. It's for campaigns to do what we were talking about in the break, use them for YouTube splicing and attacking opponents and fundraising and appealing to the base and talking to people in early primary states and trying to use that footage to leverage their positions in early primary states. I think it's much less about kind of the 20,000 foot level where you've got the American people focus in it. It's much more about hyper-targeting aspects of the campaign that have to do with really the machine aspects of the campaign, the fundraising, the grassroots building, the message development, and the early primary states.
In each party, has the media or have the moderators been really fair? In that it seems to me that in the Republican primary, it's Giuliani and it's Romney, and to a lesser extent, it's McCain. Everybody else could be off that stage. The same with the Democrats. It's Edwards, it's Clinton, and it's Obama, and you know the other folks are just there for window dressing. And in this process, have the second tier candidates in each party really been given a fair shake, Georgia?
Well, I know that it's a huge concern in terms of the moderation. I know Christopher Dodd has a Dodd clock that he runs for every debate, and he posts it on his website afterwards in terms of how many minutes did he get compared to the top three, and it's always obviously substantially less. But I think the problem with these debates, both on the Republican and Democratic side, is, I mean, they aren't really debates. It's become comical. They're essentially simultaneous press conferences, and the American people don't watch them because it's pointless. I mean, the way the moderation goes, we're picking the next president of the United States based on 30-second sound bites or they'll ask a question to be answered by a show of hands. I mean, that's getting into the absurd.
Yeah, you know, there's one thing, though. I think that's a really good point, but two things to that. One is the Fox debate on the Republican side was much better because they asked pointed questions. They really almost forced Giuliani and Romney to confront each other. Governor Romney, when Rudy Giuliani said X, Y, and Z about you, you know, was he right? You know, so I think that idea where you get actual engagement of the candidates is good. But the other thing is, though, there is some reason for the debates in terms of giving an opportunity for second-tier candidates, and a prime example of that is Mike Huckabee. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah. He's come from virtually nowhere to be a player in the Iowa caucus and really to actually help shape some of the conversations of those debates. So I wouldn't.
But he also says something. I mean,
well, right.
He's
right.
One of the candidates that
he actually gets some face time.
He has propelled himself out.
Absolutely.
Of that pack.
Right. But that's
what you should do.
Right. And
let's done it.
The opportunity.
Bill Richardson has not done it.
No. Right.
No.
But I'm saying we shouldn't be so quick to marginalize what are perceived initially as second tier candidates, because you can have somebody rise up like Mike Huckabee did, or even like Bill Clinton did 15 years ago.
But name a format in which you would, in fact, have genuine debate taking place among a group as large as each party currently has.
Yeah.
I mean, there is no such thing. It has to start winnowing. Once you get down to two or three contenders in each party, then you'll see some debates.
Yeah. You mentioned during the break that the liberal bloggers that obviously you read on a regular basis, you have noticed a change in tone towards Hillary Clinton over the last several months?
It has been a slight change in tone in terms of the people that comment, you know, on the presidential election. And what I've noticed is we've gone from generally there. Hillary Clinton is not exactly a Netroots candidate. She never comes, you know, at the top of the polls. And people say, well, I'm not going to vote for her in the primary, but definitely in the general election. I think what we've seen in the last few months is that for one reason or another, they may be drawn to her in terms of policy positions here or there. And I'm not saying that obviously she's going to be a Netroots favorite anymore, but I think that people are giving her a second look. And I think that's something that she needed from the base.
What do we know about the number of women who are bloggers? I mean, you're one of the liberal leading bloggers, but I mean, Is blogging something? I mean, are there statistics out there that suggest that, you know, a small percentage of women actually are part of the blogosphere?
Well, it's not a small percentage, and actually, it's funny because on DailyCoast.com, most of the contributing editors last year, for example, were females. I think we only had one or two males. So, it's interesting though when you are a blogger, because many people don't write under their actual name; they write under a pseudonym. And in that sense, lots of people don't know whether you're male or female. And I think that's what's nice about the medium, because they don't judge you on that. Now, in terms of the actual breakdown, when we did do our blog ad survey, while the majority are male, women are a substantial percentage.
At this point in the process, you know, in most of the analytical pieces that I've read over the last several months, a lot has been said about Hillary's focus on going after the female vote. She really wants to bring out the female vote and really play that, you know, the woman mm-hmm. proud card. And she sees that as her ticket to the White House.
Mm-hmm.
Is that intensity something that you've experienced? You've just said that you don't necessarily know the gender of the person that's writing.
Yeah.
But is that tone out there in the blogosphere?
Well, obviously, the blogosphere is excited that we do have our frontrunner is a female, and it's, you know, she's very close to the door of the White House. And so I think that that is something that's constantly in the background.
Dan, do you think that's an issue?
You know, I mean, I think her play for the female vote or her play to be the glass ceiling breaker, I think that cuts both ways because of who she is. I mean, she does not come across as Susan B. Anthony, I think, to a lot of folks. And I think there are a lot of women who might otherwise vote for Democrat that are just not going to vote for Hillary. And that's really her problem across the board.
Mm-hmm. She has a serious problem, I think, as long as she is perceived as the woman who just looked the other way while Bill did his thing.
Well, it's interesting to see the dynamic because I do know some Democrats who do take that approach where they say, well, you know, she should have walked away. But then on the flip side, there's other Democrats who view her as a very strong woman and that no matter what her personal life is, she stands, you know, on her credentials and deserves the White House.
But he, you know, here's the thing about it. Charles Krauthammer had a great piece this week on her. And he basically said, look, the issue with her is that and the reason he takes some comfort in the prospect of her being president is that she is not bound by her principles. Right, that she is as pragmatic as and Machiavellian and calibrated as any politician we've seen in the last 30 or 40 years, and he takes solace in that. She's kind of an opportunist in that sense, and she's very pragmatic. So this is not going to be some left wing Wellesley agenda if she becomes president. It's going to be very pragmatic, and the way she's treated national security issues, for example, highlights that. And so I think this, and I think that also cuts against this idea of women of the world unite behind her because that's not really her play. That's just a play.
So does that mean in your heart that you might be able to sleep comfortably if she is president?
No, I did say that, but I'm not going to do do the Alec Baldwin. I'm not going to flee the country.
But you would be more comfortable with a real practical politician than you were with an ideologue, wouldn't you?
Democrats
might think about that as well for the simple reason that in the last 43 years, no Democrat has been elected president who didn't have significant opposition from the party's left wing.
Yeah,
that's
right. Let's take a call. Jim in South Elgin, listening to us on WLS, our flagship station. Go ahead.
Good evening. It would be nice to see the media be more scrutinizing and more honest and bring up more things like occurred back in the 90s as far as like the Rose Law Firm records, FBI files, you know, Al Gore and the Buddhist temple getting
Jim,
money.
Jim, isn't that old hat? Isn't that how do you get people interested in something? Most people weren't interested in it the first time it was through the pipe.
Well, I think what you do if you ask Hillary to answer these questions, and maybe even do some replays of her Pretty in Pink conference when she was trying to socialize health care, you know, and pin her tail to the wall a little bit and let her get away from her. Or, you know, pre-rehearsed answers, I think you'd see more of what was exposed on Tuesday.
That's
what needs to happen.
I want to get Dan Proff's reaction to that. And
well, the challenge for the Republicans is there's so much to kind of pour through and to utilize. You have to be judicious in what you choose and the resources you choose to put behind it because it needs to be effective. I mean, the fundraising stuff hasn't really stuck, even though it's really shady and highly questionable and suspect. I mean, the Sandy Berger stuff hasn't really stuck. There's just so much on her that I think, you know, you got to be judicious in what you use. And the media only has the attention span that the American public has. And it's not a great attention span for Vince Foster's suicide or the Rose Law Firm records.
Mm-hmm. And don't forget, it's been 15 years since that first election that put them
you
in the White
with
House.
You agree with that, Georgia?
Well, I think that Hillary Clinton said it best when she said that she survived the right-wing attack machine for decades. You know, every story that can be thrown at her has been thrown at her, and, you know, she's currently the front runner for the Democratic nomination. And I think Republicans have to be careful what they wish for because, as it stands, Giuliani might be the nominee, and he doesn't exactly have, you know, an empty closet in terms of skeletons. And I think that that's going to be very dangerous to the Republican Party if he gets nominated.
Back shortly from Chicago.
This is nice. Go ahead. Take a deep breath. Yep, there's nothing like that new car insurance smell.
I love it.
Of course you do. Want to take it for a test drive?
Sure.
Wouldn't it be great if you could test drive car insurance? Well, maybe you can.
Notice all the impressive standard features. Good neighbor service for extra comfort and stability. And look how great it handles around those hairpin turns in your budget.
Check out the company 40 million other drivers trust, State Farm. No one gives more discounts to more drivers, and nobody takes care of you like a State Farm agent.
Who's that?
That's your built-in security system, your very own State Farm agent.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Hey there, and who are those guys?
Oh, that's your award-winning claims department. We're talking high performance.
Wow, I'll take it.
So talk to a State Farm agent today and kick the tires on our car insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
From Grand Rapids, Michigan to La Jolla, California, you're listening to Beyond the Beltway, 1-800-723-8029. We're talking about presidential politics. We're going to be switching gears and talking about Pakistan in just a few moments, but I want to reintroduce our guest. Georgia Logothetis is here. She writes as Georgia 10. She's on The Daily Kos, which is one of the leading liberal bloggers in the country, or blogosphere, in the blogs in the country. And she is also an attorney in private practice. And tell us what kind of law you practice.
Commercial law.
Commercial law.
Commercial law, yes.
Support the man.
That's right. Part of the machine.
Dan Proft also joins us. He is a political activist, and he does his commentary for the Don Wade and Roma Show on WLS, our flagship station in Chicago. And Jim Bohannon, one of the great voices on talk radio from the Westwood One radio network for the last 27 years, part of the Westwood One team in town as the announcer on our Radio Hall of Fame broadcast, and a member an inductee in the Radio Hall of Fame. They join us tonight. 1-800-723-8289. Let's spend a little time talking about what's happening in the Republican field. We talked a lot about the Democrats. You said before the break, Georgia, that you reminded everybody that Rudy Giuliani's got a lot of dirt in his closet as well, and you suggested, you warned that that could all explode.
It will explode. I mean, there's no question about it. Just the paper trail that he left. He's been running on 9/11, and I think that's been, you know, his grand distraction during the primary season. But as people really start to look at what type of leader he was, they're going to A, not like his personality, and B, not like his policies.
And when you say they, you mean who?
I think both Republicans and the general electorate.
Now, you agree that Republicans are not going to like it because you're for Fred Thompson.
Well, I think Fred Thompson is best positioned to win, and I think he's most consistent with kind of the base values of the party. But let me say this about Rudy, though. I mean, this is a guy who won the mayor of New York City 4-1 in a city that's 4-1 Democrat. So this is somebody who is not to be trifled with and not to be underestimated either. This is a smart guy who can appeal across party lines. And I'll tell you what Rudy is doing that Barack Obama isn't, because I think to some extent what you highlight, Georgia, is a similar problem, that neither one of them have really crafted a second story. Rudy's got 9/11, and his second story is a little bit more amorphous. It's kind of his personality. But where Obama has not been willing to take risks, which is what you need to do if you want to be a visionary leader, if you want to be a paradigm changer, Rudy Giuliani has. One of the moments that has not gone really reported at all, but the moment in one of the debates, I think it was the Fox debate, where he talked about school choice being the civil rights issue of our generation, where have you heard a presidential candidate make that statement? Never. You can't get governors and Republican governors to make statements like that, talking about enfranchising minority students that are in failing schools in urban centers around this country. And for somebody to take a risk like that, he deserves a lot of credit. And frankly, even though I agree, I mean, as you said correctly, I'm kind of leaning towards Thompson. Giuliani is somebody that's very intriguing, has shown a willingness to take risks and to stand on principles, and he could be very formidable in a general election.
I think what is refreshing, and I've said it, and I'll say it while you're here, because, again, you identified yourself as pro-Thompson. I mean, the one thing, and again, I saw it again on Meet the Press. We came out with a different analysis of what I saw and what everybody saw who watched Meet the Press today with Fred Thompson. Fred Thompson, to me, is another slow talker, deliberate, hem and haw, not quite sure, is slow to get the words out, which means, I think, slow to get the thoughts out. You compare that with Rudy Giuliani. Rudy Giuliani knows what's on his mind, can get it out, doesn't have to hem and haw, doesn't backtrack. Now, you can say that he's shooting from the hip, but I'll tell you, Rudy Giuliani can quote chapter and verse on virtually any issue that's come up in those debates. I agree with you. That was one that sort of came out of nowhere. And yet, if you carried it through in a presidential campaign, I think there'd be a lot of capital, to be expended on that. Mm-hmm. But, Jim, you are a man of words yourself. The American people for the last, 6.5 years have had a president who's grasping. He may know. And I think in his heart, I think he really believes what he believes, but he has an inability to properly communicate that.
That's a problem. I mean, goodness knows, of course, if glibness were the litmus test of leadership, then Johnny Carson would have been president for life. I'll put it this way. That's something that people can forgive. Don't forget that in many parts of the country, hemming and hawing and pausing are thought of as the way one converses, and Rudy may come across as a little bit too much New York in your face. I personally prefer people who get right to the point and who seem to be pretty much on top of every issue, but I'm not sure that's universally approved of. Yeah.
Romney does the same thing, by the way. Romney doesn't search for words either. No. It is refreshing.
Yeah.
It's refreshing, and neither does Huckabee.
I mean, but I don't think Thompson really searches for words. I mean, this is where we get into a difference in terms of what we saw today in Meet the Press and what we've seen from him. I think what's refreshing about Thompson is that he does come across as folksy and homespun. But I also think, and to some extent, a criticism of Bush has been the belief that we know all, the belief that our decisions are beyond reproach or beyond reflection. And Thompson is somebody who says when we don't know what the answers are, who lays out, we could be in a situation where they were talking about the Middle East, talking about Iran, where you have a series of bad choices. And I'm not going to be somebody that locks myself into a position on what I would do in that bad scenario. So I think you're underestimating Thompson's intellect and really the message that's being conveyed through that folksy.
I don't think I'm underestimating his energy level, however. And I think the energy level in a campaign is something that you have to really watch, and to me, even thus far, his energy level is not where I think it has to be. Especially if he's going to engage in a campaign with Hillary Clinton, I think that's a mismatch.
It's also interesting that he's being
Rudy versus Hillary is not a mismatch.
In terms of personality, no. I mean, you're obviously going to have equal energy.
In terms
energy.
Of energy, yes. In terms of passion,
yes.
In terms of digging up dirt.
I mean,
dirt,
that would be that would be a fascinating debate.
But it
you
could
know?
Be. But it could be in Thompson. Terms of it could be in terms of demographics. I mean, and the reality of the Electoral College.
Yes,
that's the problem, and that's really what this exercise is about.
Elaborate on that.
Well, I mean, the one of the concerns I have with Giuliani is that his base and his appeal, in a lot of ways, is the same. It comes from the same place as Hillary's, except the numbers are much more skewed in the Democrats' favor. So the idea that he can put blue states in play like Illinois or New York and California, maybe he can for a while, but ultimately I don't think those are realistic states that Republicans can win. Conversely, he could open
New
up...
New Jersey and Pennsylvania are...
Possibly.
Maybe. Ohio?
But conversely, he can... Well, we've won Ohio the last two elections, but conversely, he can put southern states in play for her, and that's my concern with his position on gay marriage, with his position on... I just worry about somebody, a Republican who has the same base as the
I'm
Democrat.
I'm very interested in that. What southern states are up for grabs, in your view, if it's Rudy versus Hillary? You think a southern state is really doable for the Democrats?
I think there are southern states and western states that were very close between Bush and Kerry that could go either way. New Mexico, Nevada, Tennessee, Arkansas certainly.
I think especially in the West, we've seen, especially with the election of people like John Tester, you've seen kind of a resurgence of Democratic ideals. And it might be, a libertarian Democrat. But
articulated
still
by Hillary Clinton?
I think who's you're going to see her articulate them during the general election.
Who's to say that Virginia is not in play?
Yes.
I think Virginia conceivably could be in play.
Yeah. And that's where Thompson, you kind of start with the base. I think it would be very difficult for Hillary or anybody else to penetrate the South with Thompson as the nominee. Now,
but Thompson will never give you New Jersey.
No, he's not.
And he'll never make Democrats spend a dime in New York or California.
No, but the point is that conceding those states up front I don't think is necessarily a bad idea, because the reality is it's a 1-in-5 shot, even with Rudy, to play in those states.
Jim? I would have to note that I find it interesting how Fred Thompson is considered the great conservative hope when John McCain is thought of as sort of a traitor to conservative views, and yet their Senate voting records were very close to one another, and Thompson was thought of as something of a John McCain disciple.
Yeah, I mean, on some issues, there's no doubt, but this is an exercise in relativity. It's not Fred Thompson versus Ronald Reagan. It's Fred Thompson versus this field. And in this field, his positions have been more consistent. John McCain, frankly, has kind of had an inability to get out of his own way. And I like John McCain, but I go back to what Tony Blankley said about why John McCain was a non-starter. And his analysis was that McCain has always been kind of a maverick to the party. And parties rarely nominate mavericks. I mean, he can be an expression for dissent, like he was when he ran against Bush.
Certainly Republicans don't.
But to be the standard bearer, it's a different animal, and I think he's never kind of made his peace with that.
You said during one of the breaks, you thought that Hillary's answer to the question about driver's licenses for illegal immigrants, which is being proposed by Elliot Spitzer, the Democratic Attorney General of New York, and Hillary's wishy-washy answers to those questions might be the banana peel that she slipped on that could really come back to haunt her.
I think it's an issue that Republicans are definitely going to try and capitalize on. I mean, it's an 80% issue against the Elliot Spitzer position in the general electorate. And I think that while immigration doesn't motivate people's votes the same way that education, health care, and job security, the economy, motivate people's votes, it's something that can be used to work the margins in states that are swing states.
Do you agree, Georgia?
Well, I know that the media played it up as some huge, incredible flub. And John Edwards released a YouTube video where he had a 4 split screen with each one of her positions on the question. Will it come back to haunt her in the general election if she's the nominee? I mean, Republicans run on fear. And, one year it was 9/11, another year it was terror. And this year, more than likely, it's going to be the immigration issue.
So the answer is yes, and it could really
sink
the Democrats.
They're going to bring it up. I don't think it's going to sink the Democrats.
Running on fear. How about global warming?
But
Swift vote. You don't think this is a Swift vote issue?
The thing is,
driver's licenses for illegal immigrants.
They're going to.
I can see the commercials now.
Of course.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8029. Callers on the line. We bring them into our conversation when we come back from Chicago.
outside the soon-to-be-completed Museum of Broadcast Communications.
Psst. Hey, you.
Who, me?
Yeah. What are you looking at?
I'm looking at a beautiful new building.
Get it right. You're looking at me. I'm the beautiful new Museum of Broadcast Communications.
A talking building?
No, a talking horse.
Hello.
Yes, I'm a talking building. I communicate. And I need some money.
I don't know if I have any spare change on me.
I get it. Here, look inside this door.
Here's Johnny.
Wow.
You think that's something? Look at this.
Bozo's Circus is on the air.
Boy, that's something.
You see, weren't those shows important to you?
Sure.
Well, if you donate just a couple of shekels, I could open my doors to show you the entire history of broadcasting.
Everything?
I'm brand spanking new, kid, but I'm a few bricks shy of a full house, so I need you to donate. I need your help.
You need help? I'm talking to a building.
The brand new Museum of Broadcast Communications needs your help. Go to museum.tv and help bring the history of broadcasting to life.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's go to calls. Let's go to Downers Grove. Jerry's listening to us tonight on WLS. Go ahead.
Hi, Bruce. Great show.
Thank you.
I was calling. I think any three or four of the Republican candidates would be formidable for one, for a couple reasons. Not only is she wishy-washy on her answers, if you ask the person on the street who would be, you know, have policies closer to Ronald Reagan, it's going to be anybody on the Republican side. And who's going to have policies closer to Jimmy Carter or Walter Mondale? And it's going to be Hillary Clinton. Now, the simple fact, she's not only wishy-washy, she's wishy-washy on the tax increases, too. There's going to be a $2 trillion tax increase if she comes in because we got a Democratic Congress. We don't have a Republican Congress that is going to convince Bill Clinton not to veto any tax cuts or any welfare reform. Because
Jerry, I'm going to interrupt you. We're getting a bad hiss on this line, so I'm going to cut this conversation short, not because of anything you said content-wise, but I do want to pick up on one point because we were discussing it during the break, and that is, again, the reaction to the question about driver's licenses for illegal immigrants. Jim, you were stunned that she was stunned.
Yeah, how could she possibly have entered those debates without having seen that coming in one form or another? It is a major issue. I grant you this has come under the general heading of things people inside the Beltway don't get, but By now, they should get it. It's an issue, and she should have at least had a firm answer ready. It could have very well have been an answer that ran against the public viewpoint, but it should have been well articulated in such a way as to explain why. But this, I mean, you can have one from column A or one from column B. I just don't. That was the one time I have seen this Clinton machine really slip. She should have been ready for that.
Georgia, you agree with that?
Well, I think it's interesting that everybody expects the Clinton campaign to be flawless. And that's kind of the media narrative that's been built up from the beginning that, you know, she's calculating, she's methodical, she has this huge operation. And so when she does slip up, which candidates are wont to do, it becomes a huge media firestorm. And I think that's more telling of the coverage of the campaign than the fact that a presidential candidate messed up.
We want a horse race.
That's exactly
this is the
it.
Only
oh,
yeah, chance exactly. we've had to say there might still be a horse race.
And that's
Secretary,
exactly
it's only out front by 20 lengths. There could still be a horse
right.
race.
But isn't one of the realities right now, isn't one of the realities that in Iowa, on the Democratic
oh, yeah.
side, don't we have a horse race?
We
Very
do.
Much so.
We do.
Yeah.
And
but,
don't we have a horse race in New Hampshire?
We do. And so. I think that...
Not really. Not on the Democratic side?
You don't
no,
think so?
No. And I think the Iowa is closer than it appears, largely because and it depends which polls you look at, if they're actually polling caucus goers or just kind of Democratic yeah. primary voters. But Iowa's close. New Hampshire's not that close. And she's stretching out in Iowa. I mean, she's been the one that's moved in Iowa. Obama and Edwards have been at 23% for the last 3 months.
And conversely, you don't have now several weeks afterwards for people to mull over the fact that, hey, we suddenly have somebody with Big Mo, because you've got this tidal wave of primaries yeah. coming up right after that, where the Clinton money, name recognition, and machine will kick in. So even if she stumbles, let's say she comes in a close third in Iowa, I see that knocking maybe a fraction of a percentage point off her chances of winning the nomination.
Yeah, I mean, she's
well,
up.
I think if she were to come in third,
I think that we would see
big loss,
a huge change in the media coverage that would affect it nationwide. I think that, you know, it would be like a balloon deflating. Everybody would question the conventional wisdom. And I do think in Iowa, we do have a horse race. And I think that you may see a surprise from John Edwards. Not first, you know, but he's essentially been living in Iowa while everybody else has been campaigning around. And I think that something that's not polled is the strength of their ground operations and their
intensity.
Turnouts, the intensity. And I think that that may be a game changer in
Converse,
both Iowa
he
and
has
Hampshire.
To win.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
He doesn't
oh, yeah.
win. He's done. Yeah. And then once you get best Iowa and New Hampshire, if she's up, you know, 20 points
oh,
in South
course.
Carolina,
yeah.
25 points in Florida. I mean, it's the route is on.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't. Does Obama have to win in Iowa?
Yeah, I think so.
So you think? All right. So one, either Obama or Edwards must win.
I think it's winner take right now. I think it's honestly winner take. Well, not Edwards. Between Obama and Hillary, I think it could be winner take all in Iowa. If Obama can beat Hillary in Iowa and get the momentum to upend her in New Hampshire, then everything, all the fears about Hillary. Float to the surface.
Yeah, I think the surprise in Iowa that's out there is on the Republican side is Huckabee. I think
Huckabee
could finish third, and he could be the big story.
Huckabee could finish
sure.
second.
Yeah,
easily.
either one.
Yeah,
because it's a foregone conclusion that Romney will win it.
Mm-hmm.
Barbar, go ahead. You're on the air. You're listening to us in Chicago.
Hi, Bruce. I called before, and I am in favor of Clinton. Hillary or Edward, because they will make a very good president, and they have and Hillary has a lot of experience since she has.
Did you say you're for Hillary and Edwards?
Yeah,
both.
Oh, okay.
There's still time. There's still time.
Only visit to the voting booth.
Yeah, because Hillary has a very good experience. She already faced the opposition of Republicans, and she knows the tactics of opposition, the GOP. I'm originally from Pakistan, so I want to make comment on whatever is happening in Pakistan.
You know what? Hang on just a second. You said the magic word. You said you're from Pakistan. That is the topic for the next hour. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put you on hold. Can you stand by or call back in 5 minutes?
Oh, sure, no problem.
Stay on the line. We're going to have
yeah,
you.
We will
have you back to start off the next hour, because the next hour we are going to be talking about Pakistan. We've talked the presidential campaign, not to death, but we've talked it
pretty close today.
And we're going to move on and talk about Pakistan, real problems in Pakistan for the United States and for many in that region. We're going to talk about it in hour number two. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks to Georgia Logothitis. She's been our liberal, and she is with us, and she'll be back for hour number two. Dan Proft is our card-carrying conservative tonight, and Jim Bohannon, special guest from the Westwood One Radio Network, joins us tonight on Beyond the Beltway. I'm Bruce Dumont. We're going to be back in about 5 minutes. Don't go away.
Hey, what are you doing this weekend?
I've got a formal black tie dinner downtown.
Wow.
I've got 50-yard line tickets to the big game.
Big.
Then I got put on the VIP list at the Boogie Down nightclub.
Well, listen, I got to get going.
And I'll be watching the just-released limited edition DVD.
Great.
Of Susie Snowflake.
Susie Snowflake? How did you get that? No way! That Susie is the bomb!
This year, give the classic holiday trilogy, Hard Rock Coco and Joe, Susie Snowflake, and Frosty the Snowman, digitally remastered to sound better today than they did 45 years ago. Get it online at museum.tv, the Museum of Broadcast Communications online store. Choose from over 5,000 CDs and DVDs. All proceeds benefit the museum and its mission.
And I failed to mention that I've got a little appointment with those Christmas cats, Hard Rock Coco and Joe.
I'm Hard Rock.
I'm Coco.
I'm Joe.
Hard Rock Coco and Joe.
One-click shopping for all your DVD desires. Museum.tv.
When was the last time someone offered you a second chance to save thousands of dollars? If you owe the IRS or state at least $15,000, American Tax Relief is offering you a second chance to eliminate up to 85% of your delinquent taxes. Thousands of honest, hardworking Americans have turned to American Tax Relief for the help they need. Look, your tax problem isn't going to go away. In fact, it's only going to get worse unless you get help. Call 1-800-449-1415. For a one-time professional fee, American Tax Relief can get you the second chance you've never had before to save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Get the second chance you deserve and save up to 85% on your delinquent taxes. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation to see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-449-1415. That's 1-800-449-1415.
Congratulations, you're a winner. That's right. Drivers all over America can save hundreds of dollars on their car insurance just by switching to State Farm. In fact, we offer more discounts to more drivers than any other insurance company. Got a good driving record? Own more than one car? How about a good student in the family? You may even be eligible for a discount for insuring both your home and car with State Farm. We have so many ways to save, you can't lose. And not only will you get a great price, but you'll also get the good neighbor service that has made us America's number one insurance company. State Farm insures more than 40 million drivers, so stop gambling with other insurance companies and switch to State Farm today. Just call your local agent or visit us online at statefarm.com and start saving big today.
Like a good neighbor.
Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont. We continue with hour number two of Beyond the Beltway, offering commentary tonight by our conservative Dan Prof, our liberal Georgia Logothites, and talk show host Jim Bohannon of the Westwood One Radio Network. Our phone lines remain open at 1-800-723-8289, 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email us a comment, our email address is btbtalk@aol.com. We're going to talk in this hour about what's happening in Pakistan. As you know, they have declared a state of emergency. Pakistani police have detained 500 activists. They're blocking the Supreme Court. They're closing down a lot of the broadcast stations. It is a very difficult time. President Musharraf is trying to cling to power. His government says that the move to emergency powers is to stamp out a growing Islamic militant threat. They are a nuclear power, as you know. Folks, should the United States Bush administration, should they take Musharraf at his word, or in your view, has Pakistan really broken away from a path towards democracy? Jim Bohannon.
Well, I'm not sure they were ever really on a path to democracy. I mean, this is a guy who is not in love with the concept. He knocked it down to get into power in the first place. The extent that he's made any moves in that direction at all has been under considerable prodding and poking behind the scenes from the United States. So whether he was ever going to really surrender power, I think, is a question. He was opposed adamantly to the concept of obeying the Constitution and giving up his job as the military chief, which is why he fired the Chief Justice in the first place. So I think this may have just called his hand on what was his predisposition in the first place.
Dan, we sometimes have to back the wrong guy at the wrong time. Is this one of these cases where he's not perfect, but he's got to be our guy?
Well, I mean, I think so. I think certainly at this point, Musharraf certainly is no Thomas Jefferson, as we were saying before during the break. But he did have allow Benazir Bhutto to come back, and she was welcomed back with you know, less than open arms, and with some of what has led to his decision, however inappropriate it is, this week. I think that you absolutely have to have a rank priority of threats, and the rank priority of threat is radical Islam, is the Islamofascist represented by Al-Qaeda and other terrorist organizations. That is first and foremost the priority. And to the extent that we have to make deals with the devil in some areas, then that's what we have to do. I mean, that's just the realpolitik nature of the world. And we're not going to dictate a free market Republican form of government in Pakistan from the outside, and particularly since they are one of the nine nuclear powers in the world. Since we're talking about a country that has nuclear weaponry, I think you have to tread very lightly.
Georgia?
Well, I think it's obviously we do have to tread lightly, but I do think it's funny that he's an ally in the war on terror, and George Bush constantly maintains that the war on terror is essentially a fight to preserve freedom and the concept of democracy. And so in having this person as an ally on the war on terror, we give him a free pass on essentially a dictatorship. I think that's something that just doesn't make sense. And that's not to say that obviously Condoleezza Rice came out and said that the situation was unacceptable, but George Bush has remained suspiciously silent.
Well, I mean, first of all, he's not getting a free pass, so that's a misnomer. Secondly, if we want to go deposing every dictator in the world, there is a long, long list. I mean, we, and through the international institutions that the Democrats are always fond of talking about, cannot even muster the moral will to stop genocide in Sudan, to stop military juntas in Burma. So the idea that this is a new problem and that this is something that solely rests at the doorstep of the Bush administration is fallacious, and it's not true. And again, the real issue and the real thing that serious policy thinkers on both sides of the aisle need to get their heads around is the rank priority of threats.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it may seem ironic, but the fact remains that sometimes you do have to choose a benign dictatorship over a very malignant dictatorship.
Is it coincidental that the move for emergency powers comes at a time when the United States, behind the scenes, is encouraging a power-sharing arrangement with former Prime Minister Bhutto? Is this all coincidence?
He let her back in the country.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, you know, it's hard to know the internal dynamics of Pakistan. I mean, he let her back into the country. Did he or emissaries have anything to do with how she was welcomed back to the country? I don't know. I mean, and don't forget that she was forced to flee in exile because of corruption in her regime. So she does not come in as a Thomas Jefferson per se either. These are complicated things, but we can't lose sight of imposing, or we can't make the mistake of imposing our pluralistic society, looking at Pakistan through the prism of our pluralistic society, and saying, well, what's going on there, and who's this? We have to start with the basics: nuclear weaponry, radical Islam there that is easily fomentable and can topple Musharraf, and what that would portend for the region.
If there were free elections and a Taliban-like government was selected by the people, what do we do, Georgia?
Well, I think that's...
We've had some elections in recent years. They haven't all gone the way we want them to go.
Yeah, Hamas.
One person, one vote, one time is not a free election.
Well, I think that does bring up a good point because, you know, context matters, and American-style democracy isn't exactly what's practiced in, you know, Middle Eastern democracy in terms of the influences that go on in the voting booth and whatnot.
But if they vote for a Taliban-like government, what do? Jim Bohannon?
We take it out. We take out that government. It is absolutely unacceptable that we hand nuclear weapons to these people, and I don't care what sacrifices
we
have to make.
So we let them vote, and if we don't like the way they vote, we do it our way.
We simply have to point out that this is the type of regime that would never allow another free election. There were not free elections allowed in Afghanistan or any place else that Islamo-fascists have gotten power. And it is not removing the will of the people any more than what they just did remove their will.
I think we need to
agree with what Jim just said?
Well, I mean, to some extent, I think we need to be judicious in the construct that we promote that provides for free elections. As you just said, Jim, I think correctly, that one person, one vote, one time does not a democracy make. And the free elections are a hallmark of democracy, and a foundation of democracy, but they don't create democracy in and of themselves. And so I think we need to look at our policies prior to encouraging something where we think the outcome is going to be to install a regime that is completely at odds with our war on terror and has access to nuclear weapons.
How much influence do we really have in Pakistan? Does anybody think we have any significant influence there at all?
No. Nope.
Well, I think we have influence. I mean, we have $15 billion we send them every year in influence. But secondly, Musharraf certainly has gone along. I mean, despite Barack Obama's desire to bomb him into accordance, he has gone along in a lot of substantive respects with our prosecution of the war on terror.
And yet, Bin Laden still remains, you know, in the hills between Pakistan and Afghanistan.
He dares not go in and clean that place out.
He won't.
If he did, he would be deposed overnight, and we would have the very Taliban government that we've just contemplated.
We've got to pause. 1-800-723-8229. Remember that Pakistani American we had on the line? You're going to hear from him when we roll on. But we want to hear from you as well. What should U.S. policy be towards Pakistan? Are they truly a friend in the war on terror? Or are we absolutely a paper tiger in Pakistan? Back shortly from Chicago.
Hey, what are you doing this weekend?
I've got a formal black tie dinner downtown.
Wow.
I've got 50-yard line tickets to the big game.
Big.
Then I got put on the VIP list at the Boogie Down nightclub.
Well, listen, I gotta get going.
And I'll be watching the just-released limited edition DVD...
Great.
...of Susie Snowflake.
Susie Snowflake? How did you get that? No way! That Susie is the bomb!
This year, give the classic holiday trilogy, Hard Rock Coco and Joe, Susie Snowflake, and Frosty the Snowman, digitally remastered to sound better today than they did 45 years ago. Get it online at museum.tv, the Museum of Broadcast Communications online store. Choose from over 5,000 CDs and DVDs. All proceeds benefit the museum and its mission.
And I fail to mention that I've got a little appointment with those Christmas cats, Hard Rock Coco and Joe.
I'm Hard Rock.
I'm Coco.
I'm Joe.
Hard Rock Coco and Joe.
One-click shopping for all your DVD desires. Museum.tv.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Let's go and take a telephone call, 1-800-723-8289. Barber had called. He identified himself in hour number one as a Pakistani-American. And, Barber, thank you very much. Tell us, in your words, first of all, how long have you been in the United States?
I've been there about 16 years. And I left the country because of the Pakistan. Pakistani constitution is always suspended. I mean, it's people have no rights. I mean, even the politicians are not giving the good rights to the people. That's why whenever there's martial law, people welcome it in the beginning.
In your view right now, what should the United States be doing to encourage a calmer Pakistan?
I think America, first of all, the Pakistani people look to America. If they would give us the equitable situation, Pakistani people would really like it. I mean, they would love welcome American proposals. I mean,
What should we do? I'm trying to cut to the chase here. What should we do now? What should the United States, how can we encourage President Musharraf to act in a more democratic way, yet at the same time protecting his own skin?
First of all, the American people have nothing. Even in American policy, people of America have no role. I mean, even the people don't like what the American government is doing, but still the government has been doing. And they brought America from top to bottom. I mean, America has been on the at the top of the world, and now, I mean, America is facing so many problems. And
okay, we're going to move on. Thank you. Thank you very much for your call. We're having a little difficult time, understanding what point you're trying to make. So we're going to move on. 1-800-723-8289 for others that have suggestions. From a realistic standpoint, let's go back to what Barack Obama had to say recently, suggesting that it was his view that if he had actionable intelligence, that that if he went inside Pakistan, we could get Osama bin Laden, that he would do it if he was president of the United States. That created quite a furor among some of the other Democrats, and it was described in the media as an example of his naivete. The reality at the moment is anybody at this table comfortable that Pakistan is doing a good job in trying to root out al-Qaeda?
They are not.
Nope.
No, I think they're a bulwark at best.
And is there anything we can do? The question I ask our last caller, is there anything we can do to encourage them to do a better job? Again, we've invested $15 billion. Granted, they may be the best friends we can buy right at the moment, but we're still not getting our money's worth. Is there anything else we can do to encourage them?
I can't think of anything personally that we could do. As far as the actionable intelligence goes, I would have to think that anybody in the Oval Office would do the same thing. I would be frightened to death of a president who would not do precisely that.
Yeah, it was funny. Actually, Joe Biden in the debate mentioned that, you know, what Barack Obama said was already the law, so it was kind of a moot point. I think this goes back to the whole kind of coterie of foreign policy and foreign service negotiation options that we have, from sanctions to just, the building off the relationship that we have had with Musharraf to try and bring him, off of this path towards martial law. But in a way that doesn't create more instability than is already present.
And I think that our hands are tied also in large part because as you know, many of the Democratic candidates keep bringing up, our standing in the world in the last 6 years has certainly taken a hit. And so we don't have that type of sway at the bargaining table or that same type of pressure. I mean, obviously, we have the economic pressure that we can add. But in terms of having a national voice and on an international stage, that can kind of bring a country into line or call them to take more action on the war on terrorism. I mean, we don't have that clout anymore.
Well, but here's the other thing. We have a patchwork foreign policy. Both parties are struggling with this. I mean, Barack Obama is still needs to finish the debate with himself before he engages in a debate with everybody else about what his foreign policy vision is. But both parties are struggling still to provide the new framework for what America's role in the world is going to be post Cold War, in the war on terror world that we live in, and you're struggling to see it. I mean, what the Democrats did with this resolution in Turkey was another example of using foreign policy to try and score cheap domestic political points, and it was incredibly stupid action that they took to jeopardize relationship with Turkey, one of the moderate Islamic countries that has been an ally, where we send where we get 95% of our supplies to Iraq through the airbase there. I mean, it's just this is the type of thing we do not have a frameworks. Neither party is really proposing frameworks that are consistent and predictable in terms of dealing with these threats.
Let's go to Orlando, Florida, where Farouk is listening to us on XM Radio, a channel, the POTUS channel tonight. Go ahead. Florida, nice to have you with us, Farouk.
Nice talking to you.
Very good. And are you a Pakistani?
I'm an American citizen now. I came from Pakistan in 72.
Okay. What is your thought on what's happening in your home country?
I think it should have happened a long time ago. The reason I say that is they're not ready for democracy yet. I mean, Benazir Bhutto, and all, they were okay, but they were all corrupt leaders. I mean, her husband was called Mr. 10%, and any other people right now, any in the Islamic parties and all that, we can't afford it right now. Because those people over there, really, most of the legislature and the politicians are all corrupt. All the institutions.
Farouk, do you still have friends and relatives back in Pakistan?
Yes, my mother is there, my father is there, my brothers are there.
If there was such a thing as free elections, would a Taliban-like government be elected by the people?
No way, because still, you know, only about 5 to 10%. Before it was like maybe 2-3%, but since the invasion of Iraq and Afghanistan, maybe about 10-15% of the people may go for the Islamic State. Now I'm not talking about some of the Waziristan and the other couple of areas. But Karachi, Islamabad, Lahore, all the major other cities, you're not going to get very much, maybe about 5-10% about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I know right now Musharraf, you know, is not very popular, but still, I think he's the most honest and least corrupt. I'm pretty sure military has a share of corruption. But
So he is, to put it in the vernacular of what we've been discussing here in Chicago, he is the best opportunity.
Yes.
He's the best choice we have now. Not perfect, but the best.
The least
for a
bad
long,
option.
Long time, until when we had Ayub Khan, that was in the 50s and 60s, I mean, the Pakistan did progress under military law because we are not actually ready for democracy. I don't care what everybody says. We are not ready for democracy because the institutions that makes the democracy work are all corrupt.
They're not.
The whole judiciary is corrupt. You can buy a judge for, you know, dollars. You can buy a policeman for dollars. Everybody is for sale. The minute you enter the country, everybody is for sale. How are you going to have a democracy over there? You're going to have those legislatures and those people. They're all corrupt. The whole damn country is corrupt.
Well, listen, stay on the line. We're going to bring Brian. Are you there?
Yes.
Brian in Schaumburg, Illinois, we're going to bring you into our conversation with Farouk in Orlando, Florida. He has said the entire government in Pakistan is corrupt. You have a suggestion to use that corruption maybe to our benefit. What do you want to do?
Let's use old-fashioned bribery of the Pakistani leadership, military leadership, whoever they may be, and have them sell us their nuclear weapons. Or at least we could bribe them to put all their nuclear arsenal into one relatively remote military base where if there was a calamity in the Pakistani leadership that our special forces could swoop in and protect them from being obtained by the
Farouk,
Islamic extremists.
What do you think of that idea?
No. Pakistan is never going to give up because, number one, it's got India to worry about.
Right.
And Pakistan is never going to give up nuclear. And Pakistani military is about the best we got right now. The best institution is the military. Everything else is corrupt. I'm not saying military is
and
not
when,
corrupt.
And Farouk, let me ask, when... when Pakistan got the nukes, that was a very popular thing with the people, was it not?
It is, yes, and it is, and it is good for Pakistan. Pakistan is a very responsible nation when it comes to its military. And Pakistan is a very good friend of America. It's always been since the 50s. You know, America, they always look for America. They're, you know, friends with America. And I'm pretty sure when the Pakistani got the nucleus, America was part of it and probably helped them out.
When Nehru was cozying up to the Soviets, it was the Pakistanis who turned to the United States. That's why for years you had the Indian Air Force flying MiGs and the Pakistanis flying American-made fighters.
Yeah. And still American, all the people of America, I mean, after before this Afghanistan and the 9/11, people always look forward to looking towards America. I mean, of course, we have those radicals, but those radicals were in the fringe. I mean, you know,
so your word of caution to the American people and your fellow Americans now listening tonight is you think that the number of radical Islamists in Pakistan are very small.
Well, right now, maybe a little bit more. I mean, still, I would say in certain areas, it's a good, like in the Waziristan and the those areas which have been, never been under the control of Pakistan, there you have problems. And I think and the military is taking action right now. But like in Karachi and Lahore, and yes, there is a hatred for America because of, you know, what's happening right now in Afghanistan and Iraq. And
okay.
They don't like it.
We're going to move on. Farouk, thank you very much for listening tonight on POTUS on XM Radio. I'm Bruce Dumont from Coast to Coast and Border to Border, taking calls from Chicago.
Mmm, this is nice.
Go ahead, take a deep breath.
Mmm.
Yeah, there's nothing like that new car insurance smell.
I love it.
Of course you do. Want to take it for a test drive?
Sure.
Wouldn't it be great if you could test drive car insurance? Well, maybe you can.
Notice all the impressive standard features. Good neighbor service for extra comfort and stability. And look how great it handles around those hairpin turns in your budget.
Check out the company 40 million other drivers trust, State Farm. No one gives more discounts to more drivers, and nobody takes care of you like a State Farm agent.
Who's that?
That's your built-in security system, your very own State Farm agent.
Hi, nice to meet you.
Hey there, and who are those guys?
Oh, that's your award-winning claims department. We're talking high performance.
Wow, I'll take it.
So talk to a State Farm agent today and kick the tires on our car insurance. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
Bruce Dumont back in Chicago, 1-800-723-8289. Georgia Logothetis is with us. She is with Daily Kos, which is one of the leading liberal blogs in the United States. She writes as Georgia 10, and she is also one of the contributing editors and has been described as one of the most influential bloggers on the political left. Dan Proft also joins us. He is a political commentator for Don Wade and Roma in the mornings on WLS Radio and a longtime political activist and regular panel member on this program for probably 7 or 8 years now. Dan, you were just in high school at the time. And also, Jim Bohannon, for the last 27 years, he has toiled in the world of network radio with the Westwood One radio network, and he's heard from coast to coast and border to border on some of the great radio stations in America nightly on the Westwood One radio network. 1-800-723-8289. We'll take more calls in just a moment. I want to talk about the issue of whether or not we could, buy this or buy that. And Jim, you made a point during the break about just the corruption, that when you think of how business is done around the world, although we have our share of corruption in this country, in this county where we do this broadcast from, and the city where we do this broadcast from is known for being somewhat corrupt, how do we break out? How do we try to hold our ideals up in the rest of the world when so much of the rest of the world is corrupt?
It's through education. I think you have to ultimately point out that the only way you ever get fair treatment, which I think is a reasonably universal desire, is to see to it that justice is not for sale, to see to it that political influence is not for sale. It can be sold that this is not a good way to do things, unless, of course, you happen to be the one with all the money. It ought to be a saleable notion that you can simply say, you do it this way, it's better doing it our way. Not because it's our way, but because it's more fair, that you not put things like justice or the decisions made by a legislature up for bids. That ought to be an item that you can convince people of.
And in George Bush's second inauguration, he made this big the theme of that inaugural speech was taking democracy and spreading it around the world. It sounds like a good idea. Is it really a good idea, Dan?
Well, I mean, I think it is a good idea, but the devil is in the details and how you plan to do that, and also too realistic about expectations about how impactful you can be through the various mechanisms at your disposal to try and push that. I mean, there's, George Will has a famous quote about the Cold War, right? The Cold War is over and the University of Chicago won it. Because it was about ideas, it was about free market economics, it was about Western culture that ultimately helped to provide the basis on which the Soviet Empire fell. So when we talk about spreading democracy, it's not always about boots on the ground, it's not always about sanctions, it's not always about no-fly zones. A lot of it is also about ideas and using the rhetorical bully pulpit that America has as a beacon of freedom in the world still to spread those ideas.
What ideas and ideals do we have now as a nation, Georgia, do you think are exportable? And let's focus on the Middle East. Let's focus on the oil-rich regions of the world, which are an integral part of our future as well as their future. How do we sell them on our ideals and so they can be more respectful of us, if not duplicative?
Well, I think that, as Dan said, obviously when you're exporting democracy, you do have to take a practical approach to it and know that the American model isn't going to be working in every single nation, especially when you take into account cultures and socioeconomic type of issues. But in terms of how to export democracy, I think that the most obvious way is to lead by example. And I think that, on the left, what we've been concerned about, obviously, is the fact that in trying to spread democracy throughout the world, we've kind of weakened our democracy here at home. And, case in point, stripping away habeas or allowing the federal government to read your email or to open up your mail in terms of domestic spying. And the question is, well, if other nations see that Americans view that to be democracy, that such an intrusive federal government is acceptable in a democracy, well, then how can we expect anything more from other nations.
One thing I think we ought to keep in mind, too, is not to equate economic free markets with democracy necessarily. They aren't the same, and we see some prime examples of that today. Gorbachev tried to save Marxist economics by liberalizing politically, and it fell like a house of cards. The Chinese have tried to maintain their political grip by liberalizing economically, and they and the Vietnamese have done so far very successfully.
Yeah, but that's not, I mean, actually, the history is pretty clear that political freedom follows from economic freedom, and China is not a free market country. I mean, people look at China as the you know, this because of its size and because of the number of people, but remember that you have 50%, more than 50% of the means of production that are still owned by the state.
True, but so that's a big step forward.
Well, no, admittedly, but what I'm saying is that and liberalization, you know, we didn't become what we are and enjoy the material wealth that we did overnight. I mean, in this country, it took 230 years for us to get here, so it's not a light switch. But I think as you liberalize economic policies, as you allow people to kind of pursue their own ends and be kind of fulfill themselves and their individual goals and keep what they earn, then political freedoms and political liberalization almost inevitably follows.
When we talk about political freedoms and when we talk about those around the world and what they admire about the United States, we spend a lot of time about, you know, what people don't like about the United States. But the thing that they like most about the United States, isn't it our money? Is it our money that is admired by people around the world? It isn't our justice system. It isn't our education system. They may admire our college education system because so many from around the world come here to be educated, and because of their education systems are so, you know, backward. But, I mean, when it comes right down to when you strip everything away, it isn't, you know, it isn't the democracy. It's the free enterprise. It's the money.
It's not just
that's
the money, but it's the chance
that's why
for
people love this
anybody.
Country.
It's the chance for anybody to make some
exactly,
of it.
Exactly.
That's the distinction.
It's the freedom to decide how to make your money and the freedom to decide how to spend your money. And I think that's what really.
But it's about money. It isn't about justice.
Probably.
Well,
it's not to the exclusion of. It is about probably money ranked number one, but I think those other factors, justice probably being close number two. I mean, if you have lived under a real dictatorship, a lot of the things we talk about in a rather academic sense, those aren't too academic if, in fact, your brother-in-law spent the last 20 years in a gulag.
Yeah, but it's also individual self-determination. Exactly. Money flows from that because you can pursue your own ends, pursue your career, but it's also the expression of your work, because work is soul craft. So if you're a writer, if you're an artist, but you've been repressed, you know, you were in a gulag like Solzhenitsyn was for decades, or Mandela. I mean, it's the expression of who you are as a person. It's not just the acquisition of goods. It's also the fulfillment of yourself as an individual.
And I think that's truly what's the most brilliant thing of American democracy, as it's perceived abroad, is that the individual across from the government can stand almost on equal parity, that the individual brings so much to the table in terms of self-worth, self-determination, that, you know, the government cannot sit there and just dictate, you know, what you do or what job you're going to do, that the American individual can essentially dictate their own destiny.
But when we're also talking about the images, because part of it, obviously, it is the popular culture of America that also defines America and Americans to the rest of the world, and in the popular culture that we spread around the world, what is the singular message that we are sending? Isn't it one of consumption and
nihilism
and do what you want whenever you want to do it?
It is, and it seems to be probably the message from this culture that is most attractive to many people. I wish that some of the other aspects of what are genuinely American things were a little more attractive, but you're right.
It is attractive to some, but is it also the most passionate point that turns, especially if you're talking about those who are based on some form of religion.
The fundamentalist Islamic.
The fundamentalists,
they will look at
they've
this.
Got
they
to look at our pop culture.
Exhibit A.
Exactly. As
exhibit
access,
A.
as consumerism, and all of that. So, you know, it's a two-headed.
As weakness.
Yeah, they do view it as weakness. Some view it as a strength, and some view it as a weakness. And it's up to us, I think, to put our best face forward and show that, you know, what's built on this foundation of, money and consumerism is something that needs to be admired.
Is it possible Is it possible that the religious tenets that we view as antagonistic to democracy represent strong moral fiber that may be something that we should emulate and not view as bad?
Well, to the extent that it is in fact something that is encouraged, to the extent that it is something that's enforced by the neighborhood mullah, we should absolutely oppose it. There's no doubt about the fact that people who make a case about how hedonistic we are and we overly consume and all the rest of it, guilty as charged. Now, what's your option? Unfortunately, if you give people freedom, they're going to sometimes make bad choices. But the alternative is the mullah, the Fuhrer, whomever, they do not make better choices. And I grant you that's not exactly a stirring set of marching orders, but the fact is in the real world, again, bad choices. Letting the public make bad choices or letting a supreme leader make bad choices. Better let the public do.
But one of the other things that, one thing that's forgotten a lot in these discussions, because so much of the time, especially here, is kind of a self-loathing, especially some from the left of this country, is that America is the only hyperpower ever that has not been expansionist, that has not been about acquiring more land, acquiring more peoples, subjugating others. It has never been about that. It's been about really the expansion of freedom. Now, you might not agree with some of the policies we've proposed to do so, but it's never been in the sense of the British Empire, in the sense of the Ottoman Empire, where you are expanding and conquering and subjugating. It's been quite the opposite. And that's an important point to remember and to promote about America.
Back shortly from Chicago, I'm Bruce Dumont.
Outside the soon-to-be-completed Museum of Broadcast Communications.
Psst. Hey, you.
Who, me?
Yeah. What are you looking at?
I'm looking at a beautiful new building.
Get it right. You're looking at me. I'm the beautiful new Museum of Broadcast Communications.
A talking building?
No, a talking horse.
Hello.
Yes, I'm a talking building. I communicate, and I need some money.
I don't know if I have any spare change on me.
I get it. Here, look inside this door.
Here's Johnny.
Wow.
You think that's something? Look at this.
Bozo's Circuses on the air.
Boy, that's something.
You see, weren't those shows important to you?
Sure.
Well, if you donate just a couple of shekels, I could open my doors to show you the entire history of broadcasting.
Everything?
I'm brand spanking new, kid, but I'm a few bricks shy of a full house, so I need you to donate. I need your help.
You need help? I'm talking to a building.
The brand new Museum of Broadcast Communications needs your help. Go to museum.tv and help bring the history of broadcasting to life.
Bruce Dumont back. Thanks very much for giving us a call. Let us go to Stephen, listening to us in El Paso, Texas on KTSM. Go ahead. You're on the air, Steve.
Yes. One of your guests just stated that America is not an expansionist nation, but I tend to strongly disagree. I think that in the Middle East, that they don't hate us for our freedom, as Ron Paul, the presidential candidate, has pointed out. They hate us because of occupation. We've been in Saudi Arabia and their bases. We've been in Iraq bombing those people for over a decade, and they don't hate us because of our freedom. They hate us because our troops are over there intervening and meddling in their affairs, all the way back to the Shah of Iran back in the middle 50s.
Well, that deserves an answer.
And it is only Ron Paul who's calling for immediate withdrawal of our troops.
Well, Ron Paul would build a fence around the country. First of all.
You're wrong. You're wrong, Jimbo Hannon. Ron Paul wants to bring the American troops home.
I'm sure he does.
And he wants to trade with people, and he wants to take the guns and bring them home, bring the military to the United States, and not have them spread out with an empire all over the world. And you oppose Ron Paul, Jim Bohannon, because you are a statist collectivist, and you want big government doing everything and anything for us.
Let's let Jim
now it really
respond.
Deserves a response.
Yeah, I know.
Well, first of all,
the gentleman from Maryland.
Yes. I won't reply in a gentlemanly way. If we put your brain in a gnat's navel, it would rattle around like a BB in a boxcar. Having replied in kind, let me reply in specifics. We do not occupy Saudi Arabia. We have had troops there to help defend Saudi Arabian oil fields. We have not occupied areas of the world to absorb them. We have occupied them to try and pacify them and enable them to become truly independent. And I recognize that there is a strong appeal connected with isolationism, but it has about as much use today as it had in 1941, when it almost cost the world civilization.
But I do think the college brings
it
up...
It is not isolationism. It is non-interventionism. America has no business meddling in the affairs of other countries, and our troops should be brought home, and this is going to lead to the downfall of this country. America cannot afford it. It is bleeding financially as a result of having troops spread out throughout the world.
Stephen, thanks very much. Go ahead.
I was just going to say that, you know, he brought up the fact, regardless of whether or not, you know, our presence in a given country is an occupation in fact, which I'll leave it up to debate. But I do think that one issue that has to be discussed is the perception of occupation. And so whether or not we actually are there, as you had stated, to help pacify a country, the fact is that there are millions of people who do view American forces in a country.
Are we therefore forced to change our policy because don't know what is going on?
I'm uneducated.
That's peer pressure of the worst kind.
No, of course not. But what I am saying is that we cannot ignore the PR problem, essentially. And I think that when you have a leader on an international stage, I think that the way that they speak on the international stage and the way that they interact with other leaders plays a key part in whether the people of a given nation view an American military presence there as an occupation or as a friendly force.
Yeah, but they were going to view that anyway. I mean, they view that we're talking about terrorist acts that go back 35 years, well before we were ever in Iraq,
Gulf War I. But so it's not just terrorists that view the American presence in Iraq, let's say, as an occupation. We have very moderate Muslims who view it as an occupation. We have, people that are more on the left side of the spectrum in the Muslim world view it as an occupation. We have people that aren't Muslim that view it as an occupation.
Maybe we should just very honestly say to them, look, you have totally messed up governing yourself. You do not know how to govern yourself. If this world is not to be torn apart, we're going to have to show you. In fact, I have urged and do still today that we bring back the concept of the United Nations Trusteeship Council. There are countries out there that are manifestly incapable of governing themselves, and they should be placed under a form of, yes, benign colonialism and be taught how to govern themselves. Uh-huh. But you're telling me that the Somalia should be left to stew in its own juices? I think not.
No one, and like I said, it's a PR problem. Whether or not the policy is there, in fact, I'm talking about the perception. So we obviously don't change our foreign policy because there might be, you know, a perception of occupation. But we do change our language. We do change our rhetoric in a way to win the hearts and minds, which was exactly what George Bush was trying to do when he invaded Iraq.
Good idea.
Yeah, but we're not going to win hearts and minds with the elements of radical Islam that are intent on this fight for civilization. And when I say for civilization, I mean, are we going to have civilization or not? Not a competing vision of civilization.
Of course, but that's such a small segment of the population. It's such a small segment of the anti-Americanism that exists on the global stage.
I think Europe would disagree with you. It might be a small segment, but it's a particularly impactful segment, and it needs to be dealt with, and it needs to be dealt with straightforwardly, and it doesn't need and political correct rhetoric. It does not advance the cause
at all.
Nobody
is saying politically correct rhetoric, but you also cannot cater your foreign policy to the most extreme elements in the world, because in doing so, you risk alienating the more moderate.
Elements are we catering to? Yeah, we're opposed to the most extreme elements.
Not catering to, but I mean in terms of language, where the discussion here is on a PR front. And when you do talk, for example, as George Bush does, in very stark, you're with us or against us type of terms, I think when it becomes a perception of almost a war against a religion, which is exactly what many moderate Muslims think America
right.
is.
And how about Nancy Pelosi and her Armenian resolution against Turkey? How did that work out for us? How did that help us win the PR battle with Turkey, an ally?
You bring up an excellent point that the words and the language that our government uses plays an integral role in how Americans are perceived overseas.
On that note, we have to say farewell to our liberal. She is Georgia Logothetis. She writes as Georgia 10 on Daily Kos. She is a contributing editor, dailycos.com. Thank you very much
for
joining us this evening. Conservative commentator tonight has been Dan Proft. He is a commentator on Don Wade and Roma. Thanks very much. When do you want?
Monday mornings, 7 o'clock.
Every morning? So you're going to go home right now and write your commentary tomorrow?
I do. Yes, I need to do that.
Also, a regular guest here on Beyond the Beltway. And the ever-popular Jim Bohannon of the Westwood One Radio Network. Jim, always a pleasure.
Thank you, Bruce.
To have you on our Beyond the Beltway microphones. This program is a Genevieve production produced in association with WLS News Talk Radio in Chicago and Wilbur Entertainment. Our thanks to Tom Veracruz and Stephanie Lecce for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week at this same time, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.
Hey, what are you doing this weekend?
I've got a formal black tie dinner downtown.
Wow.
I've got 50-yard line tickets to the big game.
Big.
Then I got put on the VIP list at the Boogie Down nightclub.
Well, listen, I got to get going.
And I'll be watching the just-released limited edition DVD.
Great.
Of Susie Snowflake.
Susie Snowflake? How did you get that? No way! That Susie is the bomb!
This year, give the classic holiday trilogy, Hard Rock Coco and Joe, Susie Snowflake, and Frosty the Snowman, digitally remastered to sound better today than they did 45 years ago. Get it online at museum.tv, the Museum of Broadcast Communications online store. Choose from over 5,000 CDs and DVDs. All proceeds benefit the museum and its mission.
And I failed to mention that I've got a little appointment with those Christmas cats, Hard Rock Coco and Joe.
I'm Hard Rock.
I'm Coco.
I'm Joe.
Hard Rock Coco and Joe.
One-click shopping for all your DVD desires. Museum.tv.
When was the last time someone offered you a second chance to save thousands of dollars? If you owe the IRS or state at least $15,000, American Tax Relief is offering you a second chance to eliminate up to 85% of your delinquent taxes. Thousands of honest, hardworking Americans have turned to American Tax Relief for the help they need. Look, your tax problem isn't going to go away. In fact, it's only going to get worse unless you get help. Call 1-800-449-1415. For a one-time professional fee, American Tax Relief can get you the second chance you've never had before to save up to 85% on the taxes you owe. Get the second chance you deserve and save up to 85% on your delinquent taxes. Call American Tax Relief for a free consultation to see how much money they can save you. Call 1-800-449-1415. That's 1-800-449-1415.